Golf Smarter number 386, published on May 28, 2013, is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
Today's equipment could be hurting your game with John Lag Erickson.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome to the Golf Smarter podcast, John.
Thanks for having me out.
I appreciate you coming out to a studio here and staring out at the Marin Country Club and talking about taking a little walk on the fairway there.
It's beautiful. It's a beautiful place.
It is. You know what I recently discovered, and I've been asking a lot of people, and no one's ever done this, and I'll ask you, have you ever walked on a golf course barefooted?
Yes.
Wow.
That was part of my training at one point, actually.
How so?
Yeah, I was working with I had a mental teacher that we were working that side of when I was on tour.
Mm-hmm.
And he had never played golf before, but he felt that it was important for me to experience getting more grounded while I was playing. And he was kind of more of a spiritualist in a sense. So
interesting.
And we'd go out, tee off at 6 in the morning. He'd just walk around with me and I'd play barefoot. And he wanted me to...
Oh, he wanted you to play barefoot.
Yes, yeah. He wanted me to feel a connection to the earth that way as I was walking.
And was that a valuable lesson for you? Because I just found it's like just walking out on a fairway, it's luxurious. I mean, the grass, it's spectacular.
Yeah, I mean,
to do this.
When I was a kid, my dad had nice lawns around the house, so, you know, I would walk around barefoot. So it brought that back to me. And it helped me feel something maybe that I wasn't really tuning into before. And I think later on when I started getting more technical with my swing and that sort of thing, I started to understand ground pressures and ground forces. And Bradley and I spent a lot of time working on those concepts with the ABS students or advanced ball striking students.
And that is that's your academy.
Our website, yeah.
AdvancedBallStriking.com?
AdvancedBallStriking.com, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'm fascinated. So you were working with a mental coach during the process or before you got into heavy part of your mechanics? I mean, where did you go first with that?
Well,
interesting.
I came out of, as a youth, I was one of the early prodigies of a book called The Golfing Machine. A lot of people are familiar
mm-hmm.
with that.
Sure.
So.
Did a show on that.
And I did that for all through junior golf, college golf, and then my first year as a professional playing on the Australian tour. But I quickly realized that technique that I was being taught wasn't going to cut it at that level. The guys that were the great players of that time, this was sort of at the end of the Persimmon age. I got to play against, you know, Greg Norman, Nick Faldo, you know, these guys in the late 80s when they were still hitting Persimmon. And
they were playing the Australian Tour?
Senior, and yeah, playing the Australian Open and, you know, the PGA down there. And I was just a young rookie and, you know, standing on the driving range and listening to the sound of contact, impact of what these guys were doing compared with the little golf machine swing that I had that was all kind of based on kind of a hand throw, centrifugal force, kind of a swinging, what we would call a swinging technique. I could tell that wasn't really going to cut it. So I had to make some changes if I wanted to win on, you know, at that level. So I just went home and I went back to my teacher and said, I don't think this is going to work. Although I was a pretty good player. I mean, I was making cuts and that sort of thing, but I mean, I was a long ways away from being able to win, you know, to go that low on those courses down there that were tight, long, you know, really tough. Greens are super fast. I mean, it was just much more difficult than a lot of the stuff that was going on over here.
So it sounds interesting. You're saying that getting to the tour and winning on the tour are different beasts.
Yeah, absolutely. Because in college golf, you know, I won a couple times at the, you know, collegiate levels and All-American, that sort of thing.
Where'd you play?
In Fresno college? State.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we had a really good team. And Kevin Sutherland, a lot of people might know that name from the PGA Tour, is on the team with me, and his younger brother, David, who played on the PGA Tour, and Tim Lancelot was another good player. And so myself and another guy named Doug Harper, and that was, we had five All-Americans on our team.
Wow.
When we went to the NCAA Championship. So, that was, you know, you don't see that very often.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, the difference of getting on the tour and succeeding and winning on the tour.
Yeah. So being able to win at the college level and being able to win at the pro level, I mean, it was a big, you know, big leap. In college, you could shoot maybe 3 or 4 under and win a tournament, you know. Mm-hmm. And on, you know, tough course, let's say like Pasatiempo or something here, it'd be like a world-class persimmon track. You go down to Australia, and now you're playing that caliber course, like, you know, Alistair McKenzie layouts and set up for tournament conditions with tight fairways and long rough, or, you know, fast, super fast greens. And guys are shooting, you know, 12 under or 14 under on courses that are, you know, just feel like they're impossible to shoot those kind of scores. I remember playing in the Australian Open at Royal Melbourne, and, you know, Greg Norman shoots back-to-back 66s, and I just thought to myself, I mean, there's not even 6 birdies out there. You know, if you, the greens were so fast and it's windy and it was just so hard. I mean, I shot a pair of 73s or something and played really well. I mean, made the cut by, you know, 4 or 5 shots easily. I played really good. And I'm seeing a pair of 66s up there going, wow, that's another level. That's something that's...
And yeah. What is it? I mean, how?
Yeah, well, what a, you know, so that kind of golf, you know, Peter Senior, another great player that was winning down there. And I mean, these guys, it was just a different sound when they struck the ball. But that sound is being created by something in physics, you know, something different is happening. And I had a high speed camera, 10,000 shutter frame camera at the time, and which was, not everybody had those back then.
No.
And I would set it up in front of myself, and then behind me might be a guy like Peter Senior or somebody, or, and then they didn't know that I was kind of filming them, you know.
Oops.
Like, see, I'd get out of the way, like, you know, go change clubs or something. And but I put together some nice footage, and also got some great footage of Mo Norman up in Canada when I played up there, and he let me film him.
I read that on the website, and you said that you promised him you'd never show it.
Yeah.
So
show it to people, but I'm not gonna post it on YouTube and all that stuff. It's just something special, you
mm-hmm.
know. And
mm-hmm.
But anyway, yeah. Getting back to that, so I started to study what was going on, and I could see what was happening with a shaft flex, and these guys were holding shaft flex all the way to impact. And there's a difference between a guy that's timing the shaft into impact. They're, in other words, they're trying to time the straightening of the shaft. So in other words, it flexes at transition and then it starts to unflex, and you're trying to time it so that the shaft ends up straight at impact. And that's what we call a swinging technique. And that's what most people do. But the really great strikers, you know, your Ben Hogan, people like that, that are holding shaft flex all the way to impact. And again, you can't get confused by looking at Power Golf and seeing where the pictures in the 1948 book or where the shaft is flexing the wrong direction. That had to do with the camera lenses at that time. There was a distortion, a rolling shutter, and that sort of thing. Those are not accurate. And people are still confused by that to this day. But that actually wasn't happening. It was actually, the shaft was actually flexing the other direction because of the camera. So it'd be flexing back, not forward. You couldn't hit the ball with the shaft.
But history shows that it was...
So that book's still there. It still confuses people to this day. And I still get questions on that on the site. But anyway, so yeah, I really realized that was one of the things that was causing the ball to sound differently, because when the energy is held in the shaft, and you've got a pre-stressed club shaft coming into impact, that stored energy. In other words, what happens is the club head, it doesn't decelerate as much from the forces of impact as it would if the shaft has already lost its stored energy and it's just straight. And now it's just a momentum strike. It's the momentum of the club head, of the weight of the club head. And that's how most people play golf. But there's a different way of doing it that these great strikers have figured out. And that's how to hold shaft flex all the way to impact. And that's basically the core direction that the advanced ball striking moves the students towards. We show the students how to do that. And it's a little bit of work, but once you
it sounds like it's a lot of work.
Well, it depends. It depends on the player. If it's already a good player,
yeah,
like
then
it's going
to take less time.
Like Brad Hughes, you know, came to me, and we had known each other from playing on the tour, but he'd come across some of my thoughts on the game on a website that I'd been involved with, and he contacted me and just said, you know, I want to come up and visit you. And so he came up here and we spent a week together. And it didn't really take long for him to get him back to striking the ball well again,
mm-hmm.
because he had a lot of the core things there. We just need to get his muscle strength back up, because the lightweight gear that everybody's playing, it's like swing cancer. It slowly kills your swing over time because you lose the muscle tone. It's just like going to the gym. If you, in the persimmon age, guys were swinging, you know, 14, 15, even 16-ounce drivers, and now everybody's got a 10, 11-ounce driver. So right away, oh, wow, I hit this really far. It's light, and it has a big head, and I don't have to worry about, you know, missing the ball. I can swing as hard as I want at it, and I get all this speed. I can hit it a mile. But over time, your muscles lose a little bit of their tone because you're not swinging a heavier club. So it's just like going to the gym and working out, and then you don't work out for a year. Well, you don't. All of a sudden, you're not as strong as you were. So you need to – the heavier gear, people don't like it. At first, they're like, oh, it's too heavy. It's shafts are too stiff. But if you practice with it and train with it, it's just like going to the gym. You get stronger. And if you look at the great ball strikers, they're all pretty strong, like certainly in the forearms. And you see these big forearms,
mm-hmm.
and it's putting forearm rotation, adding that into the equation in a big way actively. So you're actively striking it with forearm rotation. I mean, Hogan talked about this in 5 lessons and briefly, but it's there. But why do all these great strikers have big forearms if it wasn't necessary? You know, if it's just a passive throw of the hands into impact, like, you know, most people are teaching, then you wouldn't see that. But I don't think it's a coincidence that you see all these, you know, Snead and Hogan and Nelson and George Knudsen and, you know, Mo and Peter Sr., you know, Norman, like all these guys had, you know, guns, Tom Watson, right? I mean, you got strong forearms. You know, Nicholas, Palmer, I mean, you know, where do I stop, right?
Right.
Trevino even, right? You don't see too many people with thin, little weak forearms being great ball strikers.
And today you're seeing guys in phenomenal golf shape, or mm-hmm. just phenomenal shape.
Yeah.
I mean, Tiger's led the way on that, yeah. It seems like. He's a completely different body than the old school players.
Yeah. But then, you know, you have a guy like Cabrera, right? He just won the Masters. There's mm-hmm. a guy doesn't, you know, it doesn't look like he walked out of the fitness van.
Yeah. Right.
So there's something else going on there. And I, to be honest with you, that's the first time, you know, in the last, well, since I started following golf a little bit again, that's the first time I've seen a guy really hit it good coming down the stretch.
Hmm.
You know, and hitting it straight and hitting it stiff. And looked like he really had control over it. I mean, this year's Masters, that was really impressive what Cabrera did,
yeah.
I thought. But he looks like a guy that just walked out of the 60s. Like, yeah, I feel like I could hand him a set of persimmon and little blades, and he'd just go out and wipe everybody out. I mean, I think he'd win a lot more if golf was played back in the old way.
I need to take a break here for our sponsor, which is audible.com. And I went to go see The Great Gatsby over the weekend, and I had to admit to my wife after the film that I actually knew nothing about the story. I never read it in school, and this one is incredible. It was a great story. It's the story of F. Scott Fitzgerald's classic American novel of the Roaring Twenties. And in this new audio edition, authorized by the Fitzgerald Estate, it's narrated by Oscar-nominated actor Jake Gyllenhaal from Brokeback Mountain. And Gyllenhaal, I'm mispronouncing his name. Gyllenhaal's performance is a faithful delivery in the voice of Nick Carraway, the Midwesterner turned New York bond salesman who rents a little house next to the mysterious millionaire Jay Gatsby. There he has a firsthand view of Gatsby's lavish West Egg parties, and of his undying love for the beautiful Daisy Buchanan. This audiobook could be yours when you sign up for a new account at audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter. And you got to check out Audible. You really do, because listening to an audiobook, especially one that is read by a professional, will change your view on audiobooks, and it will make you be a more avid reader. Don't let anyone tell you you're not reading a book when you're listening to it on audiobook. You are reading the book. Someone's reading it to you. But listen, when you were lying in bed as a little kid and you were hearing Goodnight Moon, you were being read to, but you know that book by heart. At least you do as an adult if you have kids. Anyway, so that's our recommendation for today's show. And that will be The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald. And it's a new version. And you can get it for free, or any of their 100,000 titles for free. Your first one is free at audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter. Audible is A-U-D-I-B-L-E. audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter. All right, John, you come off kind of like a throwback. We were talking about sound recording a little while ago before we started this interview, and you're talking about tubes and listening to vinyl, and now you're talking about persimmons, and you're not that old of a guy. I mean, you're much younger than I am, but you seem to have this love of the way it used to be.
Well, what I have is a love for quality.
Okay.
So if quality is better now, then I love that. I mean, I'm not a throwback. I just like quality. I mean, we talked a little bit about music, but you know, I think anyone that knows music understands that vinyl records sound better than digital recording. I mean, you can go on and on about that. That's a whole other conversation.
So is the quality of golf, and that's a multiple question, is quality of golf, or is it quality of golf equipment, or is it quality of golfers?
The quality of ball striking, I would say.
Okay.
And here's how you tell. Like, if you take a modern player, well, you can't dig these guys out of the grave and see how they would do with the modern gear. That's not possible. But you can hand the modern players the old gear and see how they would do. And I would say that they don't do nearly as well as the players from the past, because it's a different game, because it's a different equipment. So if you hand a modern player a set of Persimmon Woods and a Balata golf ball that spins at a much higher rate, so it's much more difficult to control if you're not playing well, it's easier to access tight pin placements and that sort of thing if you're really good and you can control the spin of the ball. You can hit it into the green and spin it left or spin it right. And a lot of this has been lost in the shot making, being able to curve the ball where the golf ball holds its curvature all the way into the green. So basically what's happening now is the ball goes up, it curves to the apex and falls straight down, and you don't have the ball curving nearly as much as in the Balata age. So I would say that the players now are not as good, because every time I've handed a young player a persimmon, say, try and hit this, they can't even hit it at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a fellow teammate of mine recently, who is in the PGA up here, and he came out to watch a friend of mine play. We were playing persimmons, and we handed him a persimmon driver to hit a shot, and he hit it about 210 yards. I mean, he just couldn't hit it at all. But with a modern driver that's 10 ounces or 11 ounces and it's 46 inches long and it has a giant titanium head on it, he can just sort of slap at it with his hands and get 105 miles an hour of club head speed, knock the thing out there 280 yards.
And you don't like this?
But with a persimmon, no, I don't like this, because it's dumbing down the game. In other words, if you're a great ball striker, then you should be able to do it the old way. You should be able to do it that way. And now if you take the modern gear and add that into it, then that's a whole nother argument. But I want to see that a guy can still do it the old way. He's not using it as a crutch or as a handicap. And when you watch, you know, some of the old footage, I mean, some of those Shells matches are great to watch back, because you can see what those guys were doing back then. And, you know, there's a lot of really impressive stuff. I mean, people have seen the Hogan and Snead match, of course. That's great stuff. I mean, you know, but The thing that's been eliminated from the game has been the long iron play. You know, having to hit long irons, and that's how golf courses were designed, right? So the great architects designed these courses, and they said, okay, we're going to have there's 10 par fours on a golf course, right? Typically, par 72, mm-hmm. you know. So the par fours are the heart of the golf course. So the golf course is designed to have typically three long par fours, meaning 2, 3, and 4 iron for approach shot, okay? And then they're going to have 4 mid-range, 5, 6, and 7 irons for approach shot, and then 3 short par fours.
Okay.
8, 9, and wedge. So the reason that they do that is to test the skill set of the player, of the professional player, the top amateur player on a professional championship course. The player has to show their ability to play long irons, mid irons, and short irons. That's golf.
But
that's
today, it's driver wedge.
Well,
for on the tour.
Yes, of course. So what's happening now is the players are not being properly tested. So they're hitting, I'm seeing guys hit mid irons into par fives.
Right. Crazy.
So what are they doing on par fours? Well, even the longest par fours, they're hitting, I mean, guys are still hitting short irons into even the longest par fours at times. A lot of mid irons, but to me, the great thing about the great ball strikers of the past was their ability to play 2 irons, 3 irons, 1 iron from the fairway into a par four and be able to shape a ball into the green and hold it on a green that was designed to accept that kind of a shot. And when I look at the Masters, which we just saw recently here, and if you look at the at say 10 and 11, those are, you know, the famous holes. Well, those are long par fours that were meant to accept long iron shots, which means a lower trajectory. So in the old days, the guys were kind of bumping them into that green, like they'd hit into the front part of the green, they'd skip, but you didn't see a guy backing the ball up on the green. I mean, it would come in and it would land and then it would kick forward, and you were coming into those holes with a lower trajectory shot. Now I'm seeing guys coming in with 8 irons that are just throwing it at the flag and stopping the ball on the green. You know, backing them up on the green. And that's not how the hole was designed. I mean, Jones and McKenzie would be spinning in their graves if they knew that that was going on. They would not be happy about that. It's disrespectful to the game.
Wow.
It's disrespectful to the game. It's disrespectful to the history of the game. And it what it does is it makes it trivializes the efforts of the great players of the past. You know, and they look back and they say, oh, the old footage or whatever. But the other thing about the Masters is that those greens were never meant to be that fast either. Hmm. I don't think. Could the undulating of the slope, undulations of the slope, the greens, if you go back and look at the old footage, they were putting like a public course of slow greens or something. And that's how it was designed, really, to play that way. So it's kind of turned into something else. But what happens when you do that is that when you change the game, you change the rules or the equipment rules or the requirements for equipment, then the past is now no longer relevant, really. It just becomes, you know, a novelty of the past. And I think that's sad. You know, Gene Sarazen knocked his famous forward in from 234 yards or some about 230 yards of forward. And up until maybe the end of the 80s, guys were still hitting forwards, you know, or those that length of a shot into, say, the 15th at Augusta. But now I'm seeing guys hitting mid irons in there,
right?
You know, so that 2 that he made knocking it in the cup with a forward, I mean, that's, he did that in the 30s, you know.
Do you what in watching the Masters, the 14-year-old kid who doesn't have a ton of power but kind of hung on there, did you appreciate
like
what he was doing?
I don't, I'm angry about it.
Oh, tell me. Oh, I love this.
Well, I mean, a 14-year-old kid, I mean, you have to remember 3 years ago, he was 11, right? I mean, golf traditionally has been a game that takes years and years to learn how to play. And when you dumb the game down with a giant-headed driver that, you know, is like a frying pan or a toaster on a stick. So there's no precision needed to strike an insert on a persimmon, for instance, the game's been dumbed down to the point to where a 14-year-old that just swings hard at it can hit the ball out there far enough on the tour now to just kind of contend or whatever.
So you're saying, if I can interpret this, that today's equipment is removing a lot of the skill that is required for competitive golf.
Absolutely. Absolutely it has. And dumbing it down and making it easier doesn't make the game better. It's just like playing chess or playing checkers. You know, you're playing on the same board, but one has chess pieces that are a very sophisticated game, a very old traditional game. I think the one change they made was the castling move, like back in the late 1800s or something, and that was very controversial at the time, but that was like the, you know, that was it. But that game is still being played the same. So if you go to checkers, then that's a different, you know, it's just kind of a dumbed down version of a chess in a way. Like you just, you know, you have black and red checkers, right, that skip over each other. So, you know, it's dumbing the game down, and that's what the mentality has been over the last 20 years. Like, I think the people that are running the game are haters. They hate golf. They're angry.
When you say running the game, you're talking about the USGA?
The USGA, the R&A, the equipment companies, the people that are in control of what happens out there at the club level, at the professional level. These are people that are hackers. They hate golf. It's too difficult for them. And the idea that inventing a club where they can propel the ball farther, it's very selfish. They're thinking for themselves, and they're not thinking about the implications of what's happening at the professional level. Now, if you hand these same clubs to the pros, that's great for amateurs to be able to hit the ball an extra 40 yards. Fine. I have no problem with that at the club level. People can do what they want. If they want to ride around on tricycles, that's fine. Okay, but I don't want to see
hovercrafts.
Yeah, I don't want to see tricycle racing at the pro level. You know, you got to be on two wheels. You know, go back to persimmon and blades. Get back on two wheels again. You know, let's see some skill. You know, everybody's got these crutches. They got this extra, you know, long putters and all this stuff going on. Cavity backs, all this stuff. To a ball that flies 10% farther than maybe 15% farther than it used to. So the classic 6,800-yard course has to be close to 8,000 yards. So the courses aren't long enough. And does it really make sense to have 8,000-yard golf courses? I mean, I don't think so.
No, because, well, the 8,000-yard golf courses are playing into their hand. I mean, these guys are hitting farther and farther, so they make the courses longer to make it look good on television. I get a sense that you may be an advocate for bifurcation.
Absolutely. Yeah, and because the USGA is not going to change. I mean, they're like it's like an ocean liner out there that's, okay, we need you to make a U-turn. It's like, well, it's going to take a long time. You know, it's not, they're trying to the grooves thing. I mean, that was silly, you know. It's like they're worrying
about the USGA is hiding behind, you know, the protect the integrity of the game, but yet the game, you know, there are two different things going on. We got the tour and we've got the rest of us, right? And it's like, the USGA, I would hope, in trying to grow the game, is going to make it more enjoyable for the rest of us. Or should everything be focused around the elite scratch players, and when 90%+ of the people don't even break 100, what should we do about those rules, and who's it for?
I think at the club level, I mean, I have no problem with the frying pan drivers and all that. People want to hit that stuff. I mean, at the club level, I don't think it should be banned. Long putters, whatever. It's whatever they want to do. But at the pro level, because I'm a professional.
Okay.
Played on the tour, so I'm speaking from that perspective. And the thing is that most people, they watch the pros because they derive inspiration from that, from the professionals. They watch a professional and they go, wow, that's really great. I want to be like that. Or they relate to this player or that player. You know, in the era that I played, you had, you know, Greg Norman that could drive a persimmon 300 yards, and then you had Corey Pavin that could drive a persimmon about 225 yards. But yet, Corey Pavin could just maneuver the ball around the golf course on a good week and beat a guy like Greg Norman, which is really impressive. And see, we don't have that kind of diversity anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there might be a short hitter that can do well on a couple courses, you know, but for the most part, the tour doesn't play tight golf courses anymore, and in the U.S. Open they don't really have U.S. Open rough anymore. I mean, I played in you know, a few USGA events where the rough was like over your ankles, and if you hit it into the rough, you just wedged out basically, and it was about a half a shot penalty. And you know, when Rory won the U.S. Open, I mean, that was great golf that he played, sure, but that was just a typical PGA Tour event setup. You know, there was no rough to speak, a little bit of rough, but I was watching him spin the ball back from the rough. And I know they say that the course was wet, and you know, and then they had a lot of rain and this sort of thing, but the course definitely, what they should have done is grown the rough really long, and they can always cut it, right? They can always cut it back if they need to. But to me, that was a disgrace to see 17 under as the U.S. Open record, because 8 under par was the record for, what, how many, 30 years? Or Hogan and Nicholas, you know, Hogan set the record, then Nicholas came along, and then Tiger, you know, played some of the greatest golf ever, right, at Pebble Beach, and then broke the record, shot 12 under. And now you have a guy that comes along and shoots 17 under, but the course wasn't set up like a U.S. Open. It's not fair. If you look at the footage from when Hogan won at Olympic Club, not when he won at Olympic Club, but when he lost at Olympic Club, I should say. But he, you know, the rough was like almost to his knees. I mean, he's like pitching out with a wedge on 18. He hooked it in the left rough, foot slipped or whatever, and he hit it in the left rough. And if you look at the photos of that, I mean, that stuff's like, you know, way up over his ankles.
Right. Right.
You know, you don't see that.
He was in the bushes, yeah.
You don't see that anymore. So the tour and the USGA and all this, they want the guys to shoot low. They want the scores to be low. They think, you know, people are impressed by that. But I'm impressed by seeing the golf course. Like, I like to stick up for the course itself, you know.
Mm-hmm. And I want to stick up for the golfer.
Stick up for the course itself. And I like to stick up for the ball strikers, the guys that can hit it straight. Yeah. So how can you be, if you're a straight hitter of the golf ball, how can you be rewarded if there's no penalty for guys that hit it crooked?
Right. Well, I need to wrap this up for this episode. Could you stick around? Because I want to continue, because, you know, the reason you and I are doing this is I got an email from Golf Smarter listener John Pappas, and he said that you and your Aussie partner Bradley Hughes are both big on learning the swing from impact backwards.
Uh-huh.
And I want to spend a lot of time talking about that, what that means, and how we can institute that in our lives, how you approach it. Also, he says, you have very unique perspective on today's light equipment and huge driver heads, which we've touched on.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, he says from 2000, he says that from 2000 onward that the pro swings have deteriorated. Number of fairways hit has gotten worse, and lighter equipment is hurt.
Well, they handed Brent Snedeker persimmon and blades. Okay, he's top three in the world now.
Mm-hmm.
A few years ago, they handed him persimmon and blades, sent him out to Hilton Head, and he shot 80. So what does that say? It says something. I mean, yeah. I mean, had he worked with them a little bit, obviously he wouldn't shoot 80. He might shoot 72 or 3. But I don't think he's just going to necessarily go out there and shoot 66 with those things.
Mm.
There's a difference.
All right, so we can pursue this further on the next episode. Stick around?
Absolutely. Sure.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
You.
And I appreciate you coming out.
Yeah, thank you.
John referred to the episode of Shell's Wonderful World of Golf featuring the Hogan versus Snead matchup. Well, come to golfsmarter.com because it's the featured video on our blog this week. And don't be confused on the text on the screen, which mentions golfsmart.com. That's not us. Anyway, part two of my conversation with John Lag Erickson of advancedballstriking.com is up next, but can only be heard if you are a Golf Smarter member. I know what it's like to make a mental note to sign up at a website and then forgetting and never getting around to it. So please, right now, go to golfsmarter.com and sign up for 6 months. Hear part two with John, but more importantly, gain access to the entire archives of 386 episodes of Golf Smarter dating back to 2005. It blows me away that there's that many episodes, but because so much of what I'm trying to do here is provide information that is good for every golfer at any stage of their development, I know you're going to hear helpful advice from some of the great unsung heroes of golf instructions, and you won't find it or hear it anywhere else. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions like the one John Pappas made to me about talking to Lag Erickson, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
Smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.